That's going. Maybe we're not going to play a piece of music to get us going. Roger's working the board like a madman. Poetic Device. I'm Steve Collis, co-host Roger Farr. Mute buttons?
Nope.
Did you turn the monitors down?
Yep.
Or up?
Yeah.
Not sure we're actually being heard by the world at the moment.
Looks like we got no sound.
Got 9 listeners. Welcome back to Short Range Poetic Device.
Yeah, here we go.
I'm Steve Collis, sitting here with co-host Roger Farr, and first of our guests today, Reg Johansson. You were just listening to Cypress Hill, When the Shit Goes Down.
I don't know if we have any sound.
And we're not even sure the world is hearing us. Hold on a moment, please.
So, there we go.
I think we're good.
Really low levels.
Yeah, though. Yeah. Raise mine way up. Top of the
That's it. It's maxed.
Okay. I hope we're being heard. So let's go to Reg Johansson. Reg, you've been all over the place the last few days during these protests and different events that have been going on. Reading outdoors at the Tent City, reading at the Railway Club, reading at Vivo's Evening News. And it's great to have you here, and we'd like to hear you read.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Roger. Thanks for inviting me here. It's been an interesting few days. Really wonderful in a lot of ways. I really have been enjoying the feeling at the protests and at the tent city that's going on right now down on Hastings Street. I'd really encourage everybody to check out the tent city if they can make it down there and just spend some time, especially in the early morning hours. The time, it's really beautiful down there. They're going to be having a party tonight. There's going to be bands at the tent city at 7 o'clock, and
you know which bands?
I don't actually have that. I don't know what that is. I think if you go, there's a website. If you type in Olympic Tent Village into the search engine of your choice, you can find the updates and things that are happening there. So check it out. 7 o'clock tonight at the Tent Village. That'll be a good party. And also, I spent the night there on, I don't even know what night it was anymore. Monday night, I think. I spent the night there. And the late night thing, or the early morning hours, are really a cool time to be there, 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And that's when they need people. Apparently there was some police infiltrators there yesterday and some pushing and shoving with the cops at the entrance to the tent city, I heard. So it would be great to be there early in the morning, you know, when other people are kind of dozy. And if you can bring your fresh, coffeeed up self to provide some extra eyes, that would probably be really appreciated.
Your brass knuckles.
Yeah.
Sleeping bags.
So I'm going to read the thing from that I've been reading all through this, and I'm just going to read it again. I hope that the people who are listening today aren't the same people who have heard it before, but if you are, I hope you'll understand the circumstances. I have got a whole other poem going that I really am seeing as a kind of post-Olympics thing, but I don't want to read that yet because I still feel like I want to keep the heat on. So we're on one of the things that's been strange is to look at the difference between what my experience on the streets have been and the way that those events are being represented through the media. And it really goes to show the extent to which the media is involved in the manufacture of a spectacle that has nothing to do with reality. And I want to read you something from just a short quote from the Invisible Committee, their book, The Coming Insurrection, which I think I find useful as a way of understanding how I should understand those news reports, those fictions that I see every night. The Invisible Committee says, "It's useless to react to the news of the day. Instead, we should understand each report as a maneuver in a hostile field of strategies to be decoded. Operations designed to provoke a specific reaction. It's these operations themselves that should be taken as the real information contained in these pieces of news." So that's the Invisible Committee. I'm going to read from this book called Escrutches. Escrutches means outrageous. And this is a poem with a lot of different voices and many different quotations and samples and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of different voices coming in here. One I'll just point out to you is from Jimi Hendrix, and I think you'll be able to recognize that one when I get to it. It's on the second page here. "We want to overturn this reality not because it is unjust or evil or even unfree, but because we want our lives back. I'd like to dedicate this one to all the soldiers fighting in Chicago and Milwaukee and New York. Oh yeah, and all the soldiers fighting in Vietnam. That insurrection of a personal nature, that illumination which produces an idea force inside us in opposition to the chatter of opinion. Opening the field, we discover where the bodies are buried. Buried in holes in the desert, from Sarajevo to Baghdad. Surely some celebration is at hand. Dedicated to all the soldiers fighting in Seattle, Quebec City, Genoa, Athens. Blood Condo. Today is a day for my personal best. No Olympics on stolen land. RCMP Constable Comfet Camphoon, 33, tried to buy oral sex, touched, and offered marijuana to a 16-year-old girl after arresting her for shoplifting. His supervisor, RCMP Superintendent John Reed, said that the constable's actions were, quote, professional, and, if anything, his unbridled enthusiasm made him vulnerable to this kind of situation. Fighting in Clichy, the rigid command of scarcity in the midst of fecundity. successive and characteristic sites of struggle, the commons, the plantation, the ship, and the factory. Take the slaves from Africa, bring them to the plantations in America, bring the product of their labor, cotton, to Manchester for the British factories, and set off again for Africa. This is the circuit of capitalist production that even today reproduces itself by proposing once again the expropriation of land, brutal labor conditions, and slavery. Pick up my axe and fight like a farmer. A desert blown by violent neoliberal winds which blasted existing bonds and intensified the process of dispersion. Fighting in Six Nations and Grassy Narrows. Landless, no respecters of persons, expropriated, poor, mobile, transatlantic, transpacific, terrorized, northern and southern, subject to coercion, female and male, of all ages, multitudinous, numerous and growing, numbered, weighed and measured, cooperative and laboring, motley, vulgar, planetary, self-active, creative, croatan, the autonomous, plural and contradictory space where plays out a politics of the rebels, the true subjects of the revolts, the insurrections, from Oka to Gaza. It's in the desert where a lot of problems are solved. Blood pearls. For every crumb that falls from the master's table, an angel gets its wings. For every citizen who trembles, a guardian angel. For every bum that stumbles, a downtown ambassador. A SkyTrain special constable for every soldier bound for Afghanistan. For every boy and girl who dies for our side, a bumper sticker that says, "Let God sort out the rest." There's been an outbreak of pissing on war memorials, emptying bladders of Molsons and Timmies on monuments to the nation's war dead. Yobs from Upper Canada, lawyers' sons, future parliamentarians salute the kids their grandfathers sent to die. Us, their oil economy cannon fodder, in a war you can lace your skates up for. And the interview with the wife of the Canadian soldier who, in the sensitive framing of the CBC radio host, quote, "took an axe to the head," unquote, whipping up support for the war by sending schoolchildren to the battlefields of France, the Stanley Cup to Afghanistan, yellow support the troops ribbons for police cars. Blood tuna. To serve and molest. Sink. Single income, no kids, no condo. Born to choose, everything I want. Live, work, die, he gives it to me. Under straw hats of summer, everything I want. A robust response, he gives it, but not for free. So many, I had not thought debt had undone so many. It's a working lunch for this group of sweaty Canadians in a Montreal gym. Our God delights in festive good times, but he loves also peace, who makes us rich and saves lives. Not everyone wants to wear a badge. Fighting in Villiers-le-Bel. Has life in traffic got you down? Blood oil. The volcano, orange in the December morning, refracted through the stink of the last Fraser River mills, above placid early morning river, above boom town of Richmond, above the retail park, above the superstores, under construction in a marsh where the Kwantlen hunted duck. Transit doesn't come here. I had to take a taxi from Royal Oak SkyTrain. There are few sidewalks. Fewer are planned. Fog patches in Poco, poor visibility at the Mary Hill bypass, Highway 1 backed up to 72nd Street in Surrey, backed halfway up the cut, the Second Narrows Iron Workers Memorial Bridge, stall in southbound lane. From Beijing 2008 to London 2012. Fighting in Rostock. Mounties seduced my wife. Organized sport is the paradigmatic model of a just society. Gil Grissom, CSI. So much depends upon illegal migrant labor. The games help to keep the speculative housing bubble inflated and provide patriotic legitimation for state violence in Iraq's bloody sectarian tit-for-tat, dunk, link, solving problems by the peace, triage of the attention span. Nowhere is safe. Insurgents struck in the heart of the Green Zone yesterday, one of the most heavily defended places in Vancouver. The symbolism and the message was clear with this attack on the home of the Vanock-imposed democracy. Green zones of Gastown and Chinatown, security by Blackwater, Insurgents infiltrate business improvement associations, steal the flag from the fort for Harriet Nahani, retaliatory evictions. If we support the Dalai Lama's call to boycott the Beijing Games for crimes against Tibet, will he support our fight against the Vancouver Games for crimes against Turtle Island? Give your head a shake. From apartheid to reserves to the occupied Palestinian territories. The pond said, come in, ponder. The city, move on, baton. The city said, move in. The pond turned under. Attention-seeking missile. No Olympics on stolen land. RCMP Constable James Adam Carson was in possession of 24 pornographic videos involving children. Carson took the keys of female co-workers from their personal property at the RCMP detachment and made copies at three different key-cutting shops in Revelstoke. He then entered the different officers' homes, where he stole bras and panties or masturbated in them, leaving them soiled and balled up for the officers to find later. Carson often took the underwear with him, with intent to transfer it from one member's home to another. It was stored in a Rubbermaid container in his bedroom closet until he made the switch. The women often found unfamiliar underwear in their drawers and eventually realized their missing underwear was turning up at other RCMP officers' homes. Carson, in his late 20s, had worked at the RCMP for 4 years before he was arrested. He resigned from the force and moved to Leduc, Alberta, with his wife and young child. Just, these are all true stories, by the way, and I grew up in Leduc, Alberta.
That's what I was just thinking.
Who's with us out here in the streets? Who's there in the dark house? This is probably the best educated secret police cadre in the world. I do not want to appear too political. I am afraid of seeming controversial. I want to keep a reputation for being balanced, objective, moderate. My hope is to be asked back, to consult, to be on a board or a prestigious committee, and so to remain within the responsible mainstream. Someday, I hope to get a big grant. Who am I? The university has become an organized conspiracy against the world of ordinary human experience, but it would be an insult to anyone who does the real work of the world to say, I hate my job. And I will stay and have another drink with you, because tonight I teach Antigone in the Executive Leadership Seminar. You'd do it too if they paid you $200. Should I go on?
Maybe we should have a bit of discussion.
Yeah, okay,
Reg.
Sure.
That was fantastic, though. Okay. Really, really nice. Scratches, your title. I keep wondering about that word, and it can mean outrageous, like you said. Can it refer as a noun to outrageous, acts that have been committed?
Yeah.
And then it seems to invoke also the outrage in response to those outrageous acts.
That's right. Yeah.
That's what they're I love about the title.
They're also the name that they give to demonstrations, protests. And it's an Argentinian word. And in Argentina, during the military dictatorship, there were lots of people who were murdered by the secret police. And some of those people who were responsible for those murders are living happy lives in Argentina now. And what they do is they find out where those people live and then organize protests in front of their houses. And those protests are called the scratches.
Nice. Now, I was saying earlier, you've been pretty active in the last few days around different events going on in Vancouver. And actually, in general, I think poets have been pretty well represented at the various events and various demonstrations, putting our queer shoulders to the wheel, as Ginsberg once said. So I was curious, just to hear what you had to say about how you saw poetry's role. I'm thinking in part, obviously, specifically about your poem, also about your reading at the Tent City the other night, where I believe you dedicated your reading to the cops in the audience.
Yeah.
Which there definitely were some of. So where's your thinking on poetry's role in all the goings-on right now?
I think, you know, I think the problem with poetry sometimes is that what it does is, and Roger's talked about this before, that it takes social movements, let's say, and then represents them somewhere else. So it describes social movements, and then you read about the social movement in the art gallery, right, or somewhere else. And not to say that the art gallery can't be a part of the social movement, but I think all too often it isn't. All too often there's a really strict line and barrier between those. And sometimes poets who try to cross over between those two things are not welcome. Sometimes poets aren't really welcome on the other side of that line either, among the activists. So there's what I really enjoyed about this last few days was the way in which poets just put their bodies in the way.
Yeah.
And that's really the thing. So rather than writing about it from afar and then talking about it somewhere else, they were actually there. They were there for all of just about it, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Yeah. They were there for everything. So
yeah.
I think that's a really great development, you know?
Every Olympics will get the poets it deserves.
Yeah, exactly. Then on the other hand, you have somebody like Brad Cran, who's sort of the official poetry boss of Vancouver, who did the right thing by rejecting that role, at least for the time being or for the moment, and it might cause him a lot of trouble later.
Yeah.
So that's good. Then on the other hand, as you guys have talked about before, you had Shane Coisen, who did that really shameful piece of nationalist propaganda at the opening ceremonies.
Yeah.
I guess all the perspectives are there. It's just been really interesting the way that it's ripped open and exposed a lot of the fissures and cracks and divisions that already exist, but we tend to gloss over or cover over in our politesse around these things, and the Olympics have really cracked a lot of that open, which I think is great.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that Shane Coisen side of this is pretty amazing, and I experienced it last night going home to the burbs on the bus, and an incredibly crowded standing room only bus, and some guy in a Team Canada jersey got up and said, "I want to recite a poem," to the whole bus. And he actually recited a beer commercial, a Canadian beer commercial from a few years ago.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if Shane Coisen's poem actually literally did remind him of that, or where that came from. But he didn't say that it was a beer commercial. He recited his poem, and I think everyone was catching on pretty quickly where it came from. And then he said, "You know, I've never forgot that Molson Canadian commercial. You know, it's etched on his heart there beside O Canada or something else. I don't know."
I was going to ask you a quick compositional question, Reg, about the. I'm sorry to have my back turned here to you in this studio, but I was going to ask you about the way the use of slogans in your poem that you just read. You touched down on a couple of slogans that have been used pretty effectively in anti-Olympics organizing, in particular, "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land," and. You know, a lot of poets, I think, in particular, poets who have a critical or distrustful relationship to language are often unwilling to make such kind of emphatic statements as a slogan, which is a pretty strong declarative sentence. And I'm curious about how you work with slogans in your poems, and what do you in terms of working them in there with alongside the other material? How do you see the slogan as a little unit of language in the poem?
I think the slogan points back to the actual context of struggle. So again, it's if we're involved in this problem of representation, which is also a form of mediation, then. The slogan locates the poem itself not as timeless literature, which, you know, but locates it in a very specific time and place. And I wrote this one for a couple of years leading up to the Olympics, really waiting as a poem about the Olympics, for the Olympics, and inside the Olympics.
Mm.
So the question for me was, what am I going to have or say during those 2 weeks? And what can I kind of document, can I include in the other documents that are being produced, that will be produced, including the slogans? So the slogans are also documents, sort of the flags flying in the breeze of this whole thing. And I wanted the poem to have an anchor in the actual struggle, not to be abstract or to think about what it was going to sound like 2 years after the Olympics.
Mm.
I really wanted this. I don't have any real desires or ambitions for this after March the 1st, you know. I just really wanted it to be right here now.
That's amazing, Reg, and a great forethought to have that plan in place and done this work ahead of time. And you're really doing the right thing in terms of how you're being able to read the work broadly day after day, spread it around. That's exactly what we should be doing. And it makes you think of another quotation I just sort of stumbled upon accidentally from your copy of The Coming Insurrection here, where the Invisible Committee write about the control of neighborhoods by the community is manifestly the most effective means available. and maybe out of control is the right word to use, but certainly your participation in the neighborhood and bringing poetry and directly physically your body into the neighborhood has been pretty amazing. I sat down with an idea a few weeks back of something I was going to write every day during the Olympics, and it became impossible because what I wanted to do is get my body out into space and not be writing. So you had a lot of foresight there to have written prior to the Olympics beginning. We've got Kim Tuff in the studio with us right now. There are a few wonderful Kim poets in town. It's I don't want to confuse them. Two wonderful Kim poets we know of in town, anyhow. But we have one of the wonderful Kims, Kim Duff, in the studio now. And I'd like to invite Kim to scoot over to a microphone and read us something from her work.
Cool. Thanks.
Welcome, Kim.
This is from a longer project that I'm working on called Huddled and Sorted. Which is interesting. Yesterday when I was listening to you guys talk, I think it was you, Roger, were talking about the idea of people being sort of huddled and contained and categorized. And so I thought that was an interesting segue into what I wanted to read. And part of this in a different form appears in Open Text. So it's called Huddled and Sorted. We keep paying for everything twice because it feels right. Weather, imported concrete, double parking, practices of decision-making, and a defensive payphone engagement. Imprints of citizenship and community, parking, spaces, bolts, plans, slabs, concrete, painless. Walkways in the sky, directions and concrete. Ideas about participatory citizenship, lodged in square footage, consumption or ownership, right to buy, right, buy, and ideas about architectural form, directional citizenship, property, real estate, really. Transformations of space, Ballardian high-rises, and horror texts, and horror spaces, and horror cities. A continual crisis, property, liquidity. November spawned some kind of monster. November pushed these identities further, in, further out. Zero down, zero left over. Cheering, shouting yes, drinking cans of lager, celebrating, while buildings come down, hard, pushed hard. A plume of dust, a plume of social space, housing. Replacing Ballardian high-rises with more Ballardian high-rises. Living stagnant, drunken, whirling down streets, stroking the pavement with a sweat of citizenship, just or maybe. 1,000 a month, 700 square feet, $1 per laundry load, $45 parking permit, heat and gas included, dogs permitted, no birds. Your text messages linger in Vienna, in Paris, in London. Somehow they get wedged in at the moment of concrete, underground shuttling, taken softly. The anxiety of pause, memory, texted, whirling, a crosstown train, listen, paused, start again. We threw our garbage in the canal laughing. I fell out of love and forgot how to write you into this poem, forgot how to write you into the space of this. Tower block, intense transmission, rooftop bivouac, listing, heritage, a national identity in space, in concrete slabs, walkway, stairwell, doorway, window, porthole, trapdoor, false walls, lifts. Resurfaced. Surfacing some kind of idea of citizenship, rewriting space, housing, high-rise cartography, mapped as socialized, socially driven. You keep reminding me how the dead live, subtly, with keys, in private gardens, with pirate radio stations, transmission possible, yet temporary. You occupy and listen, structures of access, crack concrete fissure, participating in the boundary, perimeter, border, limit, that old cliché, bivouac socialism. Structures of feeling, if you know what I mean. Or an economy of feeling. We rent these small spaces living, alley view and garbage noise bang, towering up, to be continued. The texture of these interviews, ping alien, subject, a toe-stubbing reality. The addition of others to the subject, turned into living spaces, negotiating distances above, boundaries of space, rooftop transmissions, walkway, piss in the lift. A blowing plastic bag sways lazily against the concrete wall. Geezer was here, scrawled. Parking lots or boundary objects, objects, objects. Prefab, slab. Bolts become a tenuous intervention, small gaps of long-term censured engagement. Antenna rooftop, single-pane glass, glossy blue door, green glass reflecting. Moved up and down. Epistemology of cubed habitat, an authentic kind of enclosure, silence, explicitly facing the scenery of concrete, fabric not bolt, shattered nuance cycling, narrow laneway asphalt. When empiricism falls apart, we imagine spyware. This non-place reemerges as you blame it on nature, faintly, wilting for the weekend, like your nightly fugue, anyway, amnesia. Commodified as authentic experience, millions of uncharted speeches or an intimate persuasion begin retelling the story of city space as other city spaces and so many mistakes we want to make, recovering. A paradise of intoxication remembered as, maybe there's an app for that, an app to help with your mistakes. This is it. This is us. Here we go. Illusions of passport, photo, stamps, corner shops, and tower blocks, and the glass building, green, 1980s reflected backwards between technologies, automatic, not analog, or maybe it's analog, not digital, originals and copies. Illness constructed architecture, walkways in the sky, pirate radio stations and rooftop antennas, a box, too small to be cozy. This is it. This is us. Here we go. How late it was, your fugue, breaking up, signal and unlocatable and pedestrian. Some anxiety of decline or a fugued rupture. Signal and interfaced concrete, spaces out, pills, because you're silent and nostalgic. These small spaces between you, between these spaces, but really, was there, to list, and a boardroom wall or a pedestrian crisis? The soft numbers of consumption, choice, focus, drip. These too are times, nostalgic and troubling, making way for something more urban or peripheral. These moments, soft, light, focused, imported, and expensive. And standing in these shadows, built and dilated, and the drizzle-dazzle of critically massive reactions, inactions, and distractions from the moment of contact, or was the speaker fucked, distorted, or makeshift, hearing, now what? Turning towards intuition and all these dreams, gaps, and satellites, in gap or shadow, radio frequencies charged, whirring, seismically smallished, burrowing heads in the sides of commodity while you dig intensely into your shopping bag.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Kim.
Thanks.
That was a great, great reading. Thanks. Kim. Listening to your poem, I was just, you touched down and so many sites in cities, and especially one of the things I've always found interesting about your writing is just the different ways in which you sort of touch down and scales of space at the level of city architectural forms, and then drop right down into square footage, and then even into semiotic space in terms of fissures, opening up fissures for pirate radio transmissions, which was cool.
Thanks a lot.
I'm wondering in a more kind of like anecdotal level, what kinds of, you know, as someone whose attention is focused on questions of space and urban space in particular, just what kinds of spatial changes and enclosures you've seen in Vancouver leading up to and during the games?
I think, well, that works on a lot of different levels, and I think that you guys were talking a little bit about this just in terms of the sort of the tent city that's come up and those kinds of things, but also the real disappointment that I've felt in the promises that were made for social housing or combined housing and how those sort of slowly slipped away as the city itself began to realize just how little money they had, or quote unquote how little money they had for this project. I think for me, when I'm sitting back and I'm looking at these things and considering the ways in which a lot of people begin to understand ideas about citizenship and participation in some kind of significant role within the city or within politics in general, you know, sort of people's ability to participate within that realm, and the kinds of voices that people have depending on the kinds of square footage that they can occupy. And so you know, when we talk about the Olympic Village and we talk about spaces like that, and the kinds of views that people are afforded, not only, you know, the actual view where they can see the city, but the kinds of views that they're able to enjoy because of the square footage that they can afford. And so when those kinds of spaces are taken away, it becomes quite apparent just how we become active citizens. And one of the reasons that I think about it in this way is my area of focus is Thatcherism. And, you know, famously, I think it was Michael Heseltine said, you know, people who own property are people who participate in citizenship. Mm-hmm. And I think it was him, or maybe it was Douglas Hurd. It was one of those two, part of her sort of cabinet. And so, you know, that sticks with me because I think about, you know, just the kinds of spaces that I'm able to occupy and the kinds of spaces that people are able to occupy and the kind of voice that you have when you occupy those spaces. And so if you have 1,000 square feet, it's almost like you have a larger, louder voice than if you don't. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that's kind of...
Mm-hmm. I get a real sense in your work of this almost an aerial view. I'm not necessarily walking through the streets in your poem, but I'm in this sort of this crust above things of condos and concrete and views and things. And it really did, even as soon as you started reading, made me think of down at the Tent City, right behind the lot where the Tent City is, there's a fairly new Pomo-looking condo with sort of like, you know, Mondrian geometric colored glass on their balconies and stuff. And some guy up there has hung out a sign that says something like, build your resume, not tents, or build your resumes, not tents, something like that. And it made me think of, you know, that your poetry is sort of looking down on that world, looking down on what's below. And I get a sense of that. Someone once said, I can't remember who this is, but that maybe it's art's job, not necessarily to oppose evil, but to imagine it. And I think it'd give us a real good view of it. And then, maybe it's not evil, but just that trap of property and housing and rents and that's going on in the city.
And that's what you guys were talking about last night as well. The role of poetry in these kinds of in the kinds of protest, that it's not necessarily. I mean, I'm very careful to not sort of oppose these kinds of things in such an obvious way, because I think when you do that, in some ways, you're also holding up and sort of giving a little bit more power to the thing by which you're the thing that you're opposing. Mm-hmm. But you know, you were talking about last night about how poetry's role is to draw attention to the kinds of fissures and the kinds of connections and those kinds of things. I think it was Donato maybe that was talking about that a little bit in more detail. And so that, to me, that's kind of where I see what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Which is quite different from what Reg is doing. I mean, Reg is like right in there, and so I'm always really uncomfortable there. And so it's interesting to hear Reg talk about it when he's sort of on the ground and on the street. And I think that there's an interesting way where I think your work, Reg, and mine seem to sort of approach it from different ways. And it's sort of...
But like Roger says, you do drop down those scales. You just zone right in and descend into the the fissures.
I think of the piss in the elevator and the paper and the plastic bag blowing in there.
Yeah.
Which are very sort of street level.
Yeah.
We might not have heard you there, Reg.
Reg just said something quite intelligent.
we'll let you imagine.
We'll tell you about it later in person.
Wonder, Roger, if we could maybe go to a song here.
Yeah.
And come back with Jeff in the room.
Yeah, we'll go to a song. Just seeing as we had heard a little bit from The Coming Insurrection a minute ago, and as many people will know, there's been a fairly strong anarchist presence in anti-Olympics organizing at various levels.
They actually, if I can interrupt, Roger, they brought 10 pizzas to the 10 extra large pizzas to the Tent Village a couple nights ago.
Oh, nice, well, that's anarchy.
That's like there you go. I personally don't eat cheese, but it's all good. there's one of the things about an anarchist resistance is that it creates all kinds of semiotic problems because people don't know how to describe it. People don't know what to do with anarchist tactics. They don't know how to read this because it's just not something that has any kind of clear political presence and in a lot of people's view, any kind of viability. At any rate, CTV, I think it was CTV, had a ridiculous article right after the big Saturday demo, the heart attack demo. The headline was, "Who are the anarchists?" And to answer that question, of course, they went to the cops, right? Anyhow, we have a song here. We have a song here that's a bit of an answer to that question. Who are the anarchists?
That we've been through, you should understand me like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home. Act like children when we argue, fuss and fight. Hey, hey. Our own funny moves. I've got mine. Woman, you got yours too. Just trust in me like I trust in you. As long as we've been together, that should be so easy to do. Just get yourself together.
Excellent. Thank you, Roger, for providing us with that answer to this pressing question. We're joined now by Jeff Dirksen, another Vancouver poet, writer who's been very present in all the goings-on the last few days, as he is often very present in the community in the city. And so Jeff's going to read us something, and we'll have a little bit more of a talk here.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, I'm going to jump around from inside this poem called The Vestiges that I've been working on for a couple of years now. So I guess in the stuff I'm going to read today, it has some links to both Kim's work, obviously, with an emphasis on the city and kind of the production of space, but also to Reg's work in the sense of place-based politics, but I'm trying to jump around, make links between specific place-based reactions and organizing and coalitions that have happened in different places at different times. So anyhow, from the vestiges. Place-making history relives riots with the roles reversed. Coal miners strike, nation pits, cops, unions, towns break down. There is no such thing, famously. And fuck the Falklands. I love a man in a uniform. The call-up. The general strike called back in the final moment. The retaking of the heart of the neighborhood. A building from a developer's dream to other hands to see it given again. The gift economy enclosed. The wood squat taught. History teaches. Regina 1935, shot or sent back. OTAC ring, February Aufstand 1934, heavy fighting in the workers' housing. January 1958, Caracas, the modernist blocks, mass squatted as Jimenez Perez flew to Miami. And the devil came here yesterday, and it smells of sulfur still today. In 1905, 1,000 slugs of punctuation ended their aristocracy as the word spread. Paving stones and who's on top, kicking off an ultimate final offer on the table, cutting the legs out from under, and the fixed factory itself cut up and shipped off. We don't negotiate with workers or terrorists post-Thatcher, post-Mulroney, post-Reagan, post-coal, post-NAFTA, post-market bubble, post-industrial, post-port city, post-big bailout, post-market tin pot grab-and-go cronies. The synchronic names, Bennett, Harris, Klein, Campbell, local products, add your own. Money changing hands like it was material in a brown paper bag under the table of the convention center, shaped like a ship, a decorated shed. A new crass capitalist class. What about locked in competition with each other? The super rich eat the rich. East Van rules the noun. Last of its kind, or only 11 left. Space scarcity spilling off the hills. Homes spilling off the hills on the slopes to the sea's abstract view. Abstract paintings. I walk by downtown. Downtown. Things are better when you're a neighborhood on the verge, urban frontiers named and renamed for the incoming pioneers. Open newness on the skids, taste cultures, top list makers extend out to style guides, rattling Sunday morning, early dawning, the alternative economy, bottles and cans musical in a cart down the alley to the park, where things were once made, when an hour was material, at hand, demands for what you never had, shiny, shiny boots of leather zip up a utopia, individual hours add up to a space to live per square foot. I am tired, I am weary, worried to kiss the boot. Youth of Eglinton, youth of El 23, youth of South Surrey, youth of Five Corners, youth of La Paz, youth of the moment. An object outside ourselves, that petrol emotion, that market meltdown, that baton on bone, a thing. What's gold doing today? What is copper down to? At this point, I will no longer refer to the city, but to the urban. I found a flaw in the model of how the world works. Thought that cities were the keg that would reveal what relations, what public histories lay under the paving stones, which were arbitrary for throwing, of what gets empowered and what gets contained. The city digs itself out as others dig themselves in. Another crisis, another use for nature, music, acoustic, that late 60s ringing, where evil grows. Will it bring, will it occupy the libraries and access to a language, only the image of a voice, through a soft coup, reduced to admiring his ruthlessness, so present as to represent the future. Shattered. Students shaking blankets from the library windows, taped up for the tear gas canisters to come. Thanks.
Wow, thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
One thing that I've really enjoyed there, and I've heard you read parts of this before, maybe even some of these same parts before, although it's something really struck me this time that I hadn't mapped as carefully as I just think I was mapping, but in your opening passages you read, we had references to the 1980s, the coal miners' strike, fuck the Falklands, I heard the Great Britain of the early 1980s.
Right.
You moved to a reference to the Wood Squat around 2000, 2001.
2004.
Wood Squat?
Yep.
2004?
Yep.
Losing track of time here. Back to 1935 and the On to Ottawa, early labor strife in Canada, to the 1950s in South America, to I think maybe 2007 or 8 when Chavez was at the UN and smelling the leftover odors of the Bush devil, and back to references to paving stones, which seemed to send us back in time. So I'm curious about the temporal movement of that poem, and where we are, how the spatial. Because I know of your interest in the spatial, and there's a lot, obviously, that's very spatial in your poetry, the urban, not the city. How the spatial and temporal meet and interact, if they kind of have any kind of comment on it, because I really enjoyed that historical temporal movement that was going on there, too.
Right, yeah, I was just trying to, in that way, sense track these different moments of social eruption, or as Lefebvre says, explosion, that happened at certain points, and often there would be places where I've lived or have spent time or know people. So I kind of moved through that original moment of neoliberalism, if we take that kind of burst of Thatcherism and the crackdown of the against working people, and then how that was tied into Falklands and nationalism. And I Love a Man in a Uniform, the one hit that the Gang of Four had, which was an anti Falklands song.
Right.
And then a jump forward to the general strike called Back in the Final Moment, which was our 1983 moment around solidarity, and which led to the moment that we're living through today. A couple other specific things. Wood Squad, obviously, on to Ottawa. OTAC Ring, where we live in Vienna, which was a number of workers' uprisings, but really pitched battle in the streets there. And 1958 in Caracas, where 3,000 apartment buildings were mass squatted during the week that the dictator Jimenez Perez was forced to leave. And of course, he just got on a plane with his riches and flew to Miami. And then ending in jumping back in time to 1905, where the typesetters' strike brought about the end of the Russian aristocracy started the argument between Lenin and Luxemburger on spontaneity and ripe time. There's a lot of places and a lot of times going on there. So I was interested in trying to link spaces and moments, in a sense, both moments that were filled with potential, were filled with action, but then moments that got shut down in some ways, but also moments that made steps forwards, whether those were just in terms of some sort of transformation happening. Like, obviously, in Caracas in 1958, when you mass squat 3,000 apartments in these buildings that were meant to house the poor or warehouse the poor on the edges of the city. And today that is still, that Benti Tres de Enero is an autonomously organized zone within Caracas. So in some ways, we kind of have this history of moments not leading to much potential, or moments where we imagine things were shut down, but we can, I think, also look to an alternative history where
Vienna too, right? Where it's
in Vienna, where there's in the neighborhood of OTAC Ring, it's 70% social housing. So we live in a city now where Bob Rennie says that 11% is impossible to realize because the money will just go elsewhere. But we never look to, our city never looks to other models where 70% is considered, for instance, the adequate amount.
Mm-hmm.
I've got lots of questions, but I had one that I was going to ask you, but just your last comment there about this organizing of these autonomous spaces and occupations that you were mentioning in Caracas. One of the comments I've heard about that kind of organizing or those kinds of moments might be possible in countries like Venezuela because it's a bit easier to carry out those actions within a kind of national framework because of the size of the country, and so things can spread more quickly. Like even within Argentina, with the seizure of factories, because the nation itself geographically is much smaller than a country like Canada. People have said it's impossible for these sorts of things to happen in such a large geographical space because something that happens in Toronto or Montreal, you know, feels like it's happening in Canada and really doesn't have...
That is all of Canada.
The ripples are so mediated because of the distance, right? They're not kind of immediate affective things where we have, like, you know, we have friends and family who are sort of wrapped up in these things, who are in contact with constantly. So I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
I think that actually leads back to some questions you were chatting about with Kim, actually, which is how do we imagine scales and what's possible at different scales? And I think we're having a moment of scale shifting going on, mm-hmm. particularly around the potential of politics. Like, obviously, there's an abandonment of asking the state anything because the state is happy to abandon any of its responsibilities in a sense. And so perhaps in a way we used to have a language that would ask something of the state in Canada, but now because of neoliberalism, the state's been hollowed out. We no longer really ask much of it. So it seems to me where there's been claims towards democracy for people who are working through democracy as the framework that they're trying to get changes happen through, seems to have shifted to the city. And so the whole kind of right to the city movement that's come up and been articulated in Vancouver in the last couple of years, I think, is that kind of scale shifting that's happened. In the relationship between the national scale and the urban scale in Venezuela, where we were just there for 2 weeks in December, is actually quite interesting. We're meeting with Dario Azzolini, who's a theorist of the forms of autogestion or self-organization in Venezuela, said that there's this perception in Venezuela the organizing of the factories and the self-management of the factories was a failure because only 213 factories were taken over. And he said the reason that, from his point of view, such a small amount was taken over was because there was not such a strong point of production organizing within Venezuela, but rather it was the family and community were seen as the organizational scale, in a sense. So the most successful amounts of self management and autogestion in Venezuela, he said, has been taking place in the rural. So despite the density of Caracas and the amount of self-organizing going on there, he said that it's really been in the rural. So that kind of scale gets complicated between the national, the rural, and the urban. And one quote that was in this text that I read is from Henri Lefebvre's The Urban Revolution, where he says, I will no longer talk about the city, but about the urban, because his view is that industrial capitalism has essentially turned everything into urban space, because even the rural is defined by its relation to the urban. That gets complicated in places like Venezuela, where there's different forms of organizing and different modes of production within these scales. But I think it actually works very well for the kind of uneven development that we're getting in BC at the moment. Just think of the way that places like Prince George or Kitimat have more or less been abandoned by the economy and the shift towards service industry and the shift towards real estate as the engine. So those working folks who, in a sense, built up the province, they've been more or less cut adrift.
And the despair up there amongst those working folks is incredible.
And I was listening to the CBC a couple of weeks ago, and they're having a thing of, like, hot real estate tips, and they were recommending Prince George and Kitimat as places to go snap up some bargains.
Buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
No, no, go ahead.
Oh, okay, good. Well, I did have that question about the urban and the city, but you've kind of answered that, perhaps. Maybe I can steer us back to a more poetics-based mm-hmm. question for a moment. And kind of continuing thinking I started with last night around and brought up again today about poetry's role and how poetry can engage with the social in the way that I think the work of every writer we've been bringing on this show, their work does engage with the social in a variety of ways. So you know, rapidly becoming a classic sense of avant-garde, I'm going to quote Adorno, Theodore Adorno, in his essay on commitment, says, "It is not the office of art to spotlight alternatives, but to resist by its form alone the course of the world, which permanently puts a pistol to men's heads." And I don't know that I see in any of the work of anyone in this room right now that we're using form alone to resist. So I thought I'd just get you to comment a second and read one other quotation from Jacques Rancière from the Politics of Aesthetics, I think it's called, which I think he seems to take back that Adorno comment in some ways and say, no, I think we need the resistance of our forms, but we need another kind of resistance too. Rancière writes, "Suitable political art would ensure at one and the same time the production of a double effect, the readability of a political signification," and I'd say, you know, in some sense, more content, right? Reference to local political things actually going on. So the readability of a political signification and a sensible or perceptual shock caused conversely by the uncanny, by that which resists signification. There's maybe a little more of Adorno's resisting by our forms alone. Rancière is saying we need both. In fact, he says, "This ideal effect is always the object of a negotiation between opposites, between the readability of the message that threatens to destroy the sensible form of art and the radical uncanniness that threatens to destroy all political meaning." In your own work, Jeff, do you sense that? Do you struggle or move, or how do you negotiate between here I am formally trying to accomplish something at a political level, and here I am needing reference, needing content, needing specificity of the social real? Easy question. What a soft one.
Set of some quite embedded questions there. Let me start with the formal question first, where I guess first of all, abandon or work towards the abandonment of that separation between form and content. And then if you abandon the sense of an avant-gardeness separated from what I'm calling, referring to as place-based politics, mm-hmm. then what Rancière said makes more sense, because it's around the kind of necessity of form under particular set of determinations or mediations, mm-hmm. right? So if I was a slam poet at the moment, I would be incredibly disheartened because of the display of the poet from the opening ceremony. Right. Seemed to me to mm-hmm. plunge that form into crisis,
yeah.
because it just has been totally turned over towards a particular type of jingoistic nationalism and
yeah.
easily commodifiable form
yeah.
that holds no defamiliarization, if we hold on to that, as a positive political
right.
rather than simply aesthetic
yeah.
device. So the idea of around necessity, contingency, place-based formal aspects of a poem,
yeah.
how do we work within and under the set of mediations, the production of images, the production of meanings that are happening at a particular moment, how do we search for a form that's going to both reveal the determinations and open up to alternative meaning production, or reveal, and I see I'm falling into an avant-gardist language as I'm saying this, right, because it's all about revealing which is hidden. But
it's okay, you're among friends.
No, but I'm not sure if that's an effective way to think, actually. Now,
yeah.
I'm trying to think that through from some of the ways that Reg was using slogans, for instance,
yeah.
which is, you know, using making connections between different communities and different different groups and ways of thinking. So having those slogans in a sense is using it in drawing the poetic into the social rather than turning towards aesthetics to make the social commentary in a way
yeah.
that you know, the quotation that you read from Adorno is looking for a kind of semi-autonomous space.
Yeah.
Which I see a lot of the visual art in Vancouver at the moment doing, either moving full tilt into a kind of the cultural Olympiad or looking for an autonomous space. I think you could probably categorize the reactions to the Olympics and the cultural Olympiad that are happening in visual arts. So I think poetry's been a little more complicated than that. It's been ushered into the center with the slam poet reading at the very, very heart of that kind of cultural imperialism that happened at the opening ceremony. But on the other hand, you know, at every march and at every protest and at every gathering that I've been to, I'm just like, I'm seeing all my poet friends more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
So that, as Reg and everyone else has pointed out, that's really heartening. And that shows to me a really productive collapse of that idea of a kind of autonomous or semi-autonomous aesthetic space. Collapsing the cultural into the social, not thinking those two things apart, and also tying that into a collapse of the semantic and the formal, and the semantic and the aesthetic. So under what conditions do you produce meaning, and under what conditions do you make aesthetic devices becomes the question for me. And you know, I've been really struck over the last 6 months or so with Luc Boltanski and Yves Chiapello's book called The New Spirit of Capitalism, that essentially makes an argument for neoliberalism and capitalism absorbing what they call the artistic critique that sprung up in the late 60s, particularly in France, where their case study takes place. And I think that that's why I was hesitating as I lapsed into my go-to avant-gardist language that I, you know, had ready at my hands for a while and feel comfortable with, because I think that language actually has become a bit more absorbable in a sense. All the language of flexibility, the language of adaption, the
multiplicity
and that kind of meaning production, I think actually is kind of at the heart of the new spirit of capitalism, and they call it. So I'm trying to think this through at the scale of the city, as Kim is, and think, what is the new spirit of urbanism? Do we have a new spirit of that? And I think what's happening, and very intensely in Vancouver, and partially through the cultural Olympiad, is we have a new spirit of creativity. It's going to come from Richard Florida's The Creative City, which is essentially class war mapped onto creativity. In Florida, the any working people have no creativity. It's only artists who aren't actually artists in his, it's like software designers, people who are creative, are the people who have creativity, and everyone else is more or less there to serve them. I see that becoming the model for creative urbanism within Vancouver. So the huge dump of money into the cultural Olympiad, I think, sets that up, as does the rolling back of the money for sustainable, let's say sustainable cultural productions as well.
You want to talk about uneven development, you know, that's what I was just thinking of. You've got that dump of money into the cultural Olympiad, or vulture Olympiad, as I call it. And then, you know, on the other hand, you've got some scruffy poets and other artists who are down at the tent city or at the protests, and have been saying no to that money in some cases. And it's that uneven development is quite stark, and it maps beautifully spatially on the city, doesn't it? A number of times last few days I've walked from, say, the Robson and Granville kind of area, where everyone's in a red jersey or has a red Canada flag painted on their face and are screaming.
The red block.
Or the red tide.
And then you move east, and they thin. You cross Canby, say, and they become very scarce. There are the odd lost hockey hooligan staggering around the downtown east side, but the crowd changes and the sentiment changes, and the money, of course, changes too. So it's kind of interesting to be able to cross that divide, how it's specifically mapping on, the Olympics are specifically mapping on to that uneven development in downtown Vancouver.
One of the things that I find really interesting that's going on, especially with the protests and the smashing of the windows at the bay and stuff, is I think what the Olympics are doing, specifically for me, is now when I walk around downtown, I'm struck by such a difference in the way I'm able to negotiate the spaces, like just in terms of on the street level, where I can walk, how I can walk, the spaces that I assume to be, if we're going to talk in terms of public and private, you know, the Olympics have seemed to privatize these streets in a way that I find extremely uncomfortable. And so watching these protests, I think, you know, as much as sort of people want to take this oppositional viewpoint and say, you know, it's the destruction of property and this isn't how we should protest, I think it's drawing attention to the street in a way that seems to be a little bit more, I don't know if uncanny is the word, but drawing attention to the ways in which we are, you know, trying to take back a space like that. And trying to negotiate the ways in which that can actually happen. And so exactly. There's a moment, there's a glimmer there where it happened, and then it's pushed back again. But I think that, you know, but the way that the city has changed, you know, the people who live maybe in the Olympic Village or you know, it can be an expo down, you know, near Yaletown and stuff, and the spaces that people, you know, these are, people live there. And they have to go through a checkpoint now to get in and out of their homes and have their cars searched and these kinds of things. And so, you know, I think that you know, what you're saying, Jeff, is like drawing attention to the city or to the urban in a different way. And I think it will cause a bit of a shift. It almost has to, I think.
There's a lot more room to move in the downtown east side right now than there is in other parts of downtown. And
well, my neighborhood right now, you know, South Granville, and I thought it was going to be a nightmare, is like a ghost town.
Yeah.
And I can always
Main
find
Street
parking.
Where we are right now is too, yeah.
Yeah, so.
But you think you're having kind of two things happening in terms of the production of space in Vancouver. One is the incredible enclosures that are happening, that happened for months and months before the Olympics, right? So almost anywhere where a homeless person could sleep or get out of the rain, or where people had produced social spaces out of what's left of the public sphere, those got enclosed quite quickly, months ahead of time, to the point where we've almost normalized those kinds of enclosures. And so then at the same time, as we're having this kind of explosion of enclosures, we're also having the pushing forward of space that can only be public for certain activities.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think a lot of the protests, and well, let's say every protest in some way has tested the boundaries of what's possible within what's left of the public sphere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or 3P space, like public-private partnership space. Yeah. We don't have any public space in Vancouver. We have public-private partnership space. So in a sense, the unfurling of a banner, even if the police have already given a sanction for it to happen, is a testing of what's possible. And the smashing of the windows is also what I would characterize as an act of negative publicness, which is a rejection of the forms of publicness that are available and a testing of what's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
In that way.
Yeah. So we've discussed that a little bit maybe last night in terms of readability and unreadability, and I find that a fascinating moment of simultaneous readability and unreadability. I think there's a desire in some sense to be unreadable there, but there's also an opportunity for the mainstream media to say, oh, I read that. Hooligans,
right.
Locking up.
No, I mean that's where poetics gets interesting because the mainstream media has this very strong primary frame or primary trope for reading those actions, right?
Yeah.
And that's also been shipped around the world. It's ready made, and there's this the instant plunking of this trope on that. But I liked what Roger said earlier, which is, you know, how that act has not been able to be read in its kind of fuller political implications, and perhaps even not through the I think what you're implying too, Roger, not through history of those types of acts in different places and different times.
Yeah, and maybe going back to the poetics and the notion of the a politicization of form or politicization of content. Where are we on that old divide? And maybe I can quote some lines of Roger's on that. Relate here to readability, unreadability, perhaps. I'm thinking of the window smashing suddenly again, too. And I know Roger will be upset because I think I'm quoting an older version of an essay that's about to come out, but I will misquote something he can correct me. But Roger on the poetry's role suggests that poetry's role remains primarily affective, to render the present even more intolerable than it already is. I think that's one way of looking at the smashing of windows. While at the same time, Roger goes on, prefiguring unrecognizable forms of organization, affinity, and agency. So how can we be both unreadable in terms of the present norms and ideology, but also readable in terms of something new, unforeseen? Mm-hmm. Not alternative is the right word, but you know, it's the words coming to me right now.
Or the other terms that we could put in there too, I think, would be negative and productive.
Yeah.
In the sense, in this column that I'm writing for Camera Austria over the course of this year, I'm writing a column on the transformation of social space in Vancouver. And kind of the role that culture is going to play in it, and representation as well. So in writing about what I thought was going to happen for the first column, I started thinking about ideas of negative publicness, testing the boundaries of what's possible in public space. And also at the same time highlighting that we don't have public space. So in that sense, it's not trying to produce a new public space, but it's showing the clampdowns that are happening within this public-private partnership. On the other hand, you know, if we think every spatial production is at least dialectical, and so there has to be, you know, there's also a productive aspect. So these acts also produce other spaces of that have other potentials in a sense. But my understanding from hearing Reg and Roger and Kim to a certain extent talk is that it's a rejection of forms of readability that are already static.
Right.
And that's what was so disturbing about the poem at the opening ceremony, was it fulfilled every trope of readability.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was essentially the I am Joe, or no, I am Canadian Joe commercial from the Molson Canadian commercial, but it fulfilled every trope of what in multicultural terms was called the politics of recognition, which work along the lines of, if you take the shape or the form or the voice that dominant culture will recognize, then it will be recognized. Yeah. But if it doesn't fall into the trope, then it's no longer becomes recognizable. Right. And therefore, it doesn't have access to space. And then that becomes then the moment where production of space becomes a necessity, in a sense. Mm.
Wow. And just to add to that, to come back to Kim's point, the production of that space will often come back at the scale of everyday life. And that was one of the slogans that I saw on the streets in Vancouver on Saturday was at first sounded kind of romantic, but actually the more I thought about it was not. It was just live free, which was not a demand that was really ostensibly in any direct way related to the Olympics, but in a way is pointing to a demand or an attempt to produce a form of experience at the level of everyday life, some form of space to live.
Yeah, yeah. We should probably draw ourselves to a close here. I'm realizing we've gone over. But we had a full show today, and we'll hit some music here in just a second. But I've been thinking a lot about in terms of Jeff moving back and forth in time, the Paris Commune a lot. I've been reading that book by Kirsten Ross on the production. Was it the
production of social space?
Production of social space and the Paris Commune and Rimbaud. And she says that the 1871 Paris Commune was fundamentally an event of the streets, that it was a revolution really about the streets, in the streets, for the streets. And a lot of what we've seen going on in Vancouver during the Olympics is and as we've been talking about today, is about the streets and our access to the streets, our the enclosure of the street space, occupations happening in certain parts of the street. And so it's always interesting when history doubles back on itself like that, and you're cast about in time.
Yeah, Jeff? I'm really optimistic about the triad that of Henri Lefebvre, which is the perceived, conceived, and lived.
And
the beauty of Lefebvre is that the lived becomes that unpredictable aspect. So I think Lefebvre, I've been looking over some of Lefebvre's work as the Olympics have unfolded, and I'm finding it almost uncanny how he's been able to point to the closing down of space, but also the enormous production of space in that way.
And so of course, Ross was a student of Lefebvre's, wasn't she? But Kristen Ross, at least. Anyhow, we're thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Reg.
Reg is outstanding outside of the studio, so
we threw him out. That's been a very interesting show. This has been Short Range Poetic Device. We'll be back again next Tuesday at 9 o'clock is actually our next
9 p.m.
show, 9 p.m. With Clint Burnham and Rita Wong.
The late night edition.
Roger Farr and Steve Goss will be here again, too. So Thank you for listening. Roger's going to send us on our way with another song. What have you got for us, Roger?
Well, the subtext, of course, to a lot of what we're talking about within and against the Olympic Industrial Complex could be reduced just to money. And so we're going to hear a song about money. It's Metric, Sick Muse.